Welcome to another episode of Lunch with Leon, where I have lunch with one of my friends from around the world of transport. Well, this was a really interesting one because I've recorded Lunch with Leon in some really interesting places. But on this occasion, I was at ITT Hub at Farnborough. National Grid is one of our commercial partners, so really appropriate to have our lunchtime conversation there with Duncan Burt, who's their Chief Sustainability Officer. It was also interesting because away from the noise of the exhibition itself, there were various activities going on. More than once, we had to move our lunch down the corridor and find another quiet space to carry on. That's how busy everything was down at Farnborough with ITT Hub. So I started out by talking to Duncan about what it is that he does. Duncan, thanks for joining us. I guess the first question that Lunch with Leon listeners would really like to understand is, what does a Chief Sustainability Officer at National Grid really do as part of a day-to-day job?
Yeah, that's a fair question, isn't it? So, I mean, there's sort of three aspects to what I'm doing day-to-day. The first one is obviously watching over National Grid's role in helping to decarbonize, you know, a huge bit of the economy. Energy is about 70% of the economy. And a big bit of the energy use in the economy is vehicles and transport. And we play a big role in making sure that the networks and the energy are there to support all of the electric charging that's going to happen and all of the additional power that will flow across the network to do that. So that's one bit of the job, is sort of acting as a critical friend and looking at that. Another bit is looking at our own emissions and making sure that we're getting those down as quickly as possible. And we've got science-based targets and net zero commitments for 2050 and much earlier than that for operation of the electricity grid, certainly in the UK. And then the third bit, alongside the role we did at COP26, is that we actually spend a lot of time now helping and supporting other grids around the world, particularly in Southeast Asia, with their transition journey and talking to them about what's happening in the UK and what's gone well and what hasn't. It's not a tell, it's more of a conversation with them. And that's everyone from Indonesia and South Africa to the places like Vietnam and India as well. So that's my day-to-day job. So quite a variety.
That's something really new. I had never considered that the UK might, as it has been in the past in other industries, being a bit of a leader to other parts of the world, because I think we know, don't we, that going to net zero works in countries that are temperate. But out in Asia, where the temperatures can get very high and where the terrain is rocky and where the level of industrialization is a bit more patchy. So is it fair to say that the UK is a bit of a leader in going other parts?
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, I mean, there are some leading places around the world and we are one of them. So the UK has been the fastest decarbonizing economy in the G20 over the last 20 years, yeah, regularly, and still is. And along with Australia and California and Texas and Denmark, we're probably the top five regions around the world where these things are happening. And all of the interesting things that spin off that, such as, you know, really accelerating electrification of transport, come along with that leadership.
Wow. Oh, isn't that exciting? Well, we have been, have we not, in our time in shipping, in industrial revolution terms, in oil, we have been a technology leader. So that's very exciting that we could actually be helping. I think that's the nicest piece of news I've heard all day. So back on the domestic agenda, Duncan, am I right in saying that the UK has probably got enough electricity for the demand and the foreseeable demand, but it's not necessarily yet properly evenly distributed, and there will be some local hotspots where...
Yeah, that's perfect, Leon. You've got the perfect answer. So at a national level, we're fine. We're really comfortable that if the entire electric fleet, if the entire domestic transport fleet, all the cars went electric tomorrow, we could cope with that, mainly in the dip overnight. And people would charge overnight because it's generally cheaper to do so, although obviously electricity is really expensive at the moment. And then, but as you say, the big challenge is on the local network, street by street, and getting those hotspots sorted out as they come up. And I'm sure, you know, like everything else in life, talk to your neighbours, talk to your friends, see what they're doing. And so we expect to see these patches of faster purchase of electric vehicles and more rapid take up of electric for freight as well, in particular areas of the country. And there are challenges to be on top of that, along with the distribution networks.
Sure. And as the listeners to Lunch with Leon know, I have an electric car, so I'm an evangelist in this. In fact, I sit rather smugly in my electric car, glaring at others because I'm doing no harm compared with what
they're doing. But one of the things I've heard leveled as far as the distribution is concerned is really that some of the big industrial users are taking priority in terms of supply. So I can think of a couple of cases of, for example, bus carriages, where they've broadly been denied an electricity supply of the size they want because it's already reserved. In one case, for our friends who are digging that railway to Birmingham, and another case for a very large development. So what's the answer for people who are interested in or want to make progress, but somehow there seems to be a pecking order for supply?
Yeah, I mean, you're right that capacity on the network is first come, first serve. And as you say, the railways are electrifying as well. So there are particular hotspots around London and HS2 where, and actually out to Wales where that's happening as well. But Network Rail, when they've come in there, have paid for the local upgrades and for that capacity increase. They've probably not taken it for free. And, you know, just the same for bus depots or for freight hubs. We think there'll be a combination. So the first thing is to start talking to your local distribution network if you're a bus depot or you're running a warehouse with some delivery freight charging there, and get things underway and get moving. We're seeing a lot of people install batteries on site for, you know, if you're a big depot or distribution center or a bus depot, alongside your electrical connection to supplement the peaks when you'll really want to be charging when those vehicles are stationary. And then the networks are absolutely coming along as well. So there's an awful lot of upgrading going on at the moment. And we expect that to continue, you know, at a very fast pace over the next 10 years to make sure that as much as possible, we stay ahead of the curve. You know, if you look at the motorways and charging en route, we've been very, very strongly pushing and have now got this Project Rapid rollout from government, so £950 million to fund the first tranche of motorway charging. Because as you probably know, Leon, you've always got that nervousness, if you've not got a Tesla, that when you get on the road, is it going to be free when you get to that? And there are some companies doing fantastic work. You know, I've got InstaVolt down the road from me and we've got GridServe, but there's that £950 million. And we've actually just released an additional report saying that you could expand that work in scope to cover early freight and delivery traffic as well, which would really help with the early HGV hubs and the freight hubs. So there's lots going on.
It would be fair to say, wouldn't it? There's quite a good commonality between the grid network and the trunk road network.
Totally.
The downside, I think, for motorway service areas, if I read this correctly, is that they appear to be on motorways, but in fact, they're located in villages. The real access to motorway service areas, other than from the motorway, you know, in villages, and therefore some supply to motorway service areas has been a bit of a challenge in the past. But as you said, that's now coming right, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, typically, if we're looking at sort of, you know, a 15, 20 charger installation, you know, you're into several million pounds to build even just the basic connection onto the grid, because it would be much larger than that service area currently has. But so a bit of upfront funding, which is what the government is doing with Project Rapid, really helps get all of that moving. You know, as I'm sure you know from other areas of business learning, sometimes that policy and that upfront funding really can kickstart things and then everyone piles in to fix the problem.
You know, that's the sort of thing government should do, because, again, in my situation as a user, of course, I want there to be many more charging points than there is.
Yes.
Because I want there to be space. And there is a question about who pays that several million pounds for the excess capacity that makes me feel comfortable that I won't have to queue to charge during the course of my journey. So that's the right thing for government to do. It's creating extra capacity ahead of the curve of the vehicles. I think they should be commended for that. So you and I were at COP26, and I went to COP26 with a bit of skepticism. I wondered if it wasn't the converted preaching to the converted. But in fact, I didn't come away with that feeling at all. And just putting aside for a moment Alok Sharma's brilliant performance in getting an international agreement at some personal emotional cost, I have to say. But in fact, I think I came away from COP26 not just thinking that it was a jamboree for people of like-minded people. I think a lot of people came away having made fabulous progress and had been inspired to go and do even more. How did you feel?
Yeah, very similar. I mean, there are a lot of converted people there, obviously, Leon, as you say. But, you know, the direction coming out of it and the kind of statements we saw at COP were really, really positive. We held over 50 events at COP and had a huge number of people up there talking to across sectors, because a big part of this transition is, you know, the crashing together of transport and automotive with utilities and power grids and electricity generators. And then beyond that into wider civil society and spatial planning and city planners and town planners and stuff like that. So an awful lot of those conversations are now getting very, very real. The other big thing at COP, other than the big transport announcements we saw, announcements on freight from and HGVs from the UK government, was a huge presence from business at COP. And that reflects now the, you know, we're not talking about 5 million or 50 million of government funding here. We're talking about billions of pounds of private capital now coming in to really do the heavy lifting and deliver a huge amount of this transition. It's very, very serious business. It's a very serious business opportunity.
You've given us a wonderful segue into ITT Hub. So I'm sat talking to you from Farm, yes, where the show is in the process of being built. Nearly all of our listeners will hear this program after the show has been over and has been a success. But it is what you described as the crashing together of the vehicle manufacturers, of the energy providers, of the data handlers, of all of the constituents in this whole journey coming together into sectors which they've never had to learn about before. And I think it's tremendous that the energy providers are here learning about what business wants. I think that people who use data to optimize performance and solutions and so on are here. And of course, we're super grateful for your support at National Grid for ITT itself, because it demonstrates everybody's serious about this. But back at COP, I was impressed by the way business grasped this. And the thing that I came away with was how business also worked out at COP that being environmentally friendly, being zero emission, is good for business. So this is not just one huge extra cost into the system. In fact, we know, don't we, by the behavior of young people, they're becoming increasingly discriminating about the products they buy and the way in which they take their journeys. And we haven't quite reached a place yet where people will let a diesel train go in order to ride on an electric one because it's better for the environment. But I did have businesses telling me that they are now often being challenged by their customers about their environmental credentials and their sustainability agenda. So they had to be green in order to be in business. And one or two were saying, where there was a choice, that there were companies prepared to pay a premium for a zero emission service. And in fact, here at Farnborough a few months ago, we had a coach session, and one coach operator said, he has electric coaches, said he could charge a premium.
Yeah, I bet.
And customers coming, asking especially for it. So that was one of the things I took from COP. And I guess the other question is, governments, of course, are very clever at making promises for deadlines, for dates after which they will have left office. So some of these dates can be quite challenging. In your view, do you think we're going to make it?
Yeah, I do. I do. And that's, you know, we've been doing this in electricity grids and energy for the last 15 years now. And what we've learned is that things tend to go slowly to start with. And everyone says it'll never happen. And then you get the innovators and the advocates come in, you know, and over a 3 to 5 year period, suddenly you find yourself accelerating much, much more quickly. And that's always been the case in consumer-led markets like cars and, as you say, delivery as well. So to give you the best example in energy, in 2012, our solar capacity forecast for the UK was that it would grow from almost nothing to around 1 or 2 gigawatts by 2020. And the energy minister at the time put out a bold statement saying, well, I think we could have 10 gigawatts by 2020. And everyone sort of frowned and scratched their heads. And actually, we went well past that in 2017, well beyond what any expert expected in 2012. And we're seeing that in EVs now with, you know, a really rapid acceleration from manufacturers coming through. And what's interesting is that we're, you know, particularly, you know, in the richer world, in Europe and North America and bits of Asia, we're moving from something where governments set targets and then have to pay for it to something where actually this is the cheaper and more attractive option. And so in energy, that's already happened. So wind and solar are now much cheaper than gas and coal. And you're seeing the impact that's having on places like India and Indonesia, where they're moving rapidly away from coal into renewables. We're also starting to see the transition being driven by sectors. And that one of the biggest sectors worldwide for this is is cars and vans and trucks, is transport. And the UK or France or India on its own cannot decide how fast the transport transition is going to happen. That's going to be decided in the car manufacturing and the battery manufacturing head offices around the world. And that's what's happening. We're seeing this incredibly rapid transition in the rich world now towards EVs, even in the US. And we expect the UK really to follow the sort of trajectory that Norway has, and then for countries to run variously a few years behind that, for all sorts of reasons, both for city legislation, for air quality, but also just because that's where the factories and the supply chain is going, and therefore that's what you're going to have to buy.
That's really heartening to know, Duncan, because I was in India last week at board meeting, and sometimes you look around at what's going on in these places and think, why am I bothering? Because in fact, there is so much pollution being generated here. Surely me recycling my bottle tops isn't going to make a difference. But everything you've just said is that, in fact, because of the way the supply chain works, even in some of the more challenging locations, they're having to move with the times for every reason. The way the manufacturers are organizing themselves, the battery manufacturers and so on, the way in which business is just forcing them along a sustainable agenda. So there's a bit of push and pull, I guess, in different territories in different proportions.
Yeah, there really is. And, you know, if we had 10 people around this table, they could argue different points on, you know, different countries' pace and stuff like that. And that's absolutely fair. And there's always someone on Twitter who, you know, needs to drive 600 miles to see a sick relative every day. And they're going to be the last person that switches to an EV. And that's absolutely fine. You know, there's plenty of time for it to happen. But the bulk of mileage, you know, those high, if you take the UK, for example, the bulk of mileage of those fleet drivers with delivery vans and such like that, that's going to move really quickly because it's cheaper and easier than in the long run than sticking with diesel.
Of course. And the price thing is an interesting one, which we speculate on this program often, because there's 38 billion worth of fuel duty and VAT yes. floating about that has to be paid for. So at the moment, there's no form of tax or excise duty on electricity, and therefore it is proportionally very much cheaper. But that's not something that can be sustained forever. So here the government's got an interesting balance, haven't they? The balance between making sure that there is sufficient tax money comes in, because that the money
that's right.
tax doesn't just pay for roads. But on the other hand, keeps encouraging people to travel in the right direction as far as this is concerned.
Well, no, I think, I mean, we're really on the cusp of a very rapid transition in the UK. And to your point that there are a huge amount of business opportunities and transformation that's going to come with that. We're really seeing, as you say, a pickup in low carbon deliveries. We're seeing a huge growth in, you know, in electric vehicles on the road now. And, you know, you and I, who are stopping at charging points regularly, we'll all have lots of anecdotal evidence. And the evidence is there in the sales as well, that you know, the number of EVs on the road now is really growing rapidly. And the charge point access is growing with it. So it's incredibly positive story for the UK. And, you know, the UK is leading an awful lot of these transition sort of metrics, if you measure them at a global level. We're not quite up with Norway, but what you're seeing in the UK, we're sitting there now going out to other countries and explaining what's happening in the UK. And the things that you and I take for granted, you know, still feel very distant, even if you're in parts of the United States or parts of Europe. But we know that they'll be there in 2 or 3 years' time.
Would it be fair to say, Duncan, that National Grid has moved from being a sort of quietly silent, invisible actor in the background, where just delivered quietly without much noise, to now sort of being at the forefront of something that's absolutely critical to the whole world? I don't just mean saving the planet, but the whole decarbonisation agenda. National Grid is now a very active organisation, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. That's right. And you're spot on. We, you know, we used to, if you go back 15 years, we used to consider that we'd done a bad job if anyone mentioned us, because we were behind the scenes and very much, you know, people don't want to have to care about their electricity. They just want it to be there, don't they, when they flick the switch. So that's what we prided ourselves on doing. But we, you know, we decided gradually, well, we concluded that we had to stand up and be counted and show that, and put our name to the fact that this is doable, it's easily achievable, that we can get there. And we started that with things such as, you know, announcing the first day without coal in the UK, announcing the fact that we would be ready to run the grid without any fossil fuels from 2025, and that we're building the networks that then, you know, and that allow us to then say that we're comfortable that we can charge all the electric vehicles and such like. Because otherwise, you know, this is new, it's different, transitions are complicated to understand if you're not in them every day, and even complicated if you are. So us being able to put out simple statements, knowing that we've got the backing and the evidence to say that, hopefully helps people understand what's going on, gives them confidence that, you know, some of the biggest organizations in the UK like us are on top of it, and that we're helping make it happen.
It's also sent another signal, because we've had little flurries of decarbonisation in the past, haven't we? But this time it's real. I mean, this time it's serious. This is not just...
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, yes, this is not going away.
No, this is absolutely real. We often walk into the debate of different forms of energy, and in particular the hydrogen lobby. I ran the first hydrogen buses in London in 2004. And the technology was always just round the corner, just tomorrow.
Yep.
Here we are 18 years later. Here at Farnborough, we've got some hydrogen-fueled buses. But it's still just around the corner. So there is no doubt for anybody that's thinking about investing in electrical energy that whatever other technologies may emerge, frankly, green electrical power will be a significant provider in the decarbonized country. I mean, it stands to reason.
Yeah, that's right. For a typical, that's absolutely spot on. And as you say, there is going to be a huge expansion of hydrogen, but how much that gets into everyday use on things like buses is, you know, really for, you know, we could debate that all evening in the pub if you want to, but as you say, the weight of that is going to electricity at the moment. And most modeling, including ours and the IEA's International Energy Agency's, sort of forecast that electricity use in terms of total energy use in the economy is going to go from around 15 to 20% today in most Western democracies to something between 50 and 75% of all energy used. And so you've got this huge shift, particularly of liquids, so petrol and diesel, onto electricity and onto electric vehicles. And you've got that in heating as well, for a big chunk of heating, certainly in the UK, certainly in places like France as well. It's, depending on if you're a bit colder, that might be a bit more subtle. Depending on where you are, you might need some gas as well. And we think we need some gas in the northeast of the US, some hydrogen. But yeah, it's a huge shift onto electricity. We want to stand up and be counted and make sure that we help make that happen.
And have you made some brilliant partnerships with other organizations that have really shifted this forward?
Well, obviously, Leon, I won't go any further without mentioning ITT and you guys. You know, we've really, really pushed into electric vehicles and trying to find and support advocates and other people that are working in there. So, I'll mention the guys at Fully Charged as well. And obviously, the UK government's doing an awful lot with its zero emission vehicles work in that space as well. We're trying to build those alliances and build that work, both through collaboration and talking, and also by doing things such as, you know, publishing the carbon intensity so that people can then charge their cars when it's greenest to do so, and create that broader ecosystem of data and understanding and to help make it happen and to help as much as possible for the UK to be successful into that and to grow those businesses in the UK.
And we will need, won't we, to come out of the current energy crisis, because at the moment there isn't any cheap energy, even at certain times of the day on a domestic tariff, it's the same price. So hopefully we'll be delivered out of this little energy difficulty we've got at the moment. Does National Grid have a view about when normality in the energy industry might...
Everyone can guess, can't they, Leon? I mean, at the beginning of this crisis, we thought it would run through this year and into next, so at least 18 months. And, you know, that's still our central expectation, but I wouldn't put any money against that. No one knows, because it depends what happens, really. It's been driven by international gas prices. It really depends what happens with Russia, Ukraine. And we're really worried about it. It's really, really difficult at the moment for everyone, for people at home, for businesses, for us to be able to handle those additional costs. There's no reason why, as things settle down, we shouldn't see a return to normality. And a big part of that return to normality is, in terms of pricing, is probably a massive acceleration of the transition away from fossil oil and gas. We're seeing that in European legislation. We're seeing that in UK legislation with raised ambitions for 50 gigawatts of wind by 2030. And that's what gives us confidence that over 2 or 3 years, even if the worst happens and this runs on for a long time, we can still get ourselves as a country out of it as quickly as possible. But it's going to be tough. But when we get out of it, we will be, as you say, back into a world where you know, you'll have opportunities to save money by charging when you've got high renewables on the system. You know, we're seeing the range of those cars increase. We're seeing the charging rollout continue. And we're seeing, you know, innovation all over the place in terms of big and small companies and data to help make that happen.
Very exciting, isn't it? I mean, I don't know about you. The older I get, the more interested in the future I become. may have something to do with how much left of it I think I might have. But it is exciting. I mean, in terms of the mindset of people, and I think pushed along by the young, about the way in which they conduct their business, about the way in which they are sensitive to the planet, sensitive to emissions, sensitive to sustainability, all of the things that people like to talk about. But in fact, I really detect a younger generation that is much more serious than perhaps my generation ever was in terms of the way in which they organize their lives. And there's nothing like consumer pressure to generate demand, because government can legislate and the government can force, but actually it's the people that really drive the progress, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. And that's, you know, that's absolutely right. And we've surveyed quite a bit over the last few years, and, you know, people under 30 just assume that this is happening and, you know, don't really understand why you wouldn't go faster. But what is interesting is that when you do poll people, they still think that zero carbon or green solutions are really niche and are not every day. Whereas in fact, you know, in the UK, the grid is 50% zero carbon now. And, you know, and so we're running, it's a routine thing, happens every day. It's as easy as catching a train or getting in your car. And it's a routine to all the engineers and technicians that are operating that grid. And that kind of normality, we think, is a really important message to get across, because that makes it more familiar, you know, lets everyone relax a bit and be comfortable that, you know, this is going to happen and we're well on the way.
So, look, this has been a fabulous conversation. My guest on Lunch with Leon today has been Duncan Burt, who's the Chief Sustainability Officer at National Grid and a great friend and partner to us here at ITT Hub. Lunch with Leon is an ITTHub.net production. If you'd like to go across to our website, that's details of everything we do, our news channel, our other podcasts, and, of course, the link to the fabulous exhibition that we hold every year at Farnborough. So thanks once again for joining me for lunch. Duncan, look forward to seeing you down here in Farnborough very soon.
Thank you, Leon. See you soon.